Welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Catherine Brigantino. A big thank you to Daniel Angrenon for producing today's show. And today's show is all about vegan nutrition. This week on the Animal Voices Facebook page, we asked you to write in with any vegan diet-related questions you might have. Whether you're considering going vegan, if you're already vegan but you're having trouble sifting through all of, you know, the conflicting information out there about soy, omegas, protein, and to help us sort it all out, we're joined today by Virginia Messina. Virginia Messina is a registered dietitian and public health nutritionist specializing in vegan nutrition. She also just co-authored a book called Vegan for Life, Everything You Need to Know to Be Healthy and Fit on a Plant-Based Diet. Before we go to the interview with Virginia Messina, we have a short segment for you from our musical collaborator, Kevin Tillman, from the Vegan Hip Hop Movement.
Greetings, Animal Voices. It's Kevin from the Vegan Hip Hop Movement. This week's soundscape is from Dylan and Bat Sauce featuring Chop. If the state of Florida had any better export than oranges or jean shorts, arguably it would be Dylan. Raised in Jacksonville and currently in Atlanta, the rapper known as Dylan wears many hats and is undoubtedly a one-man creative force. The musician, chef, actor fuses hip-hop, cuisine, and comedy in a way that is refreshing and unique, truly navigating his own lane in today's crowded hip-hop scene. And Chop is also from Jacksonville, Florida, who keeps a day job as a teacher and moonlights as an MC. Over melodic and bombastic tunes, she can be heard rapping about the pressing issues of the present moment and the status quo. You can learn more about Dylan and Chop and other vegan hip-hop artists on the Vegan Hip-Hop Movement Blogspot, Facebook, and MySpace pages. I'm always looking for other vegan hip-hop artists to promote, so please make contact. And now, from Dylan and Bat Sauce featuring Chop, here is America.
The truth in America is that America is a sick society. America is full of motherfuckers who have shot the wrong people, who have really died. No, I'm not afraid to die, that's quite obvious.
You know we in where you can be a citizen. Even if you vote, you don't control what they get us in. Smell the bitter scent, they burning the innocent. So I burn an incense in my medicine. In yeah, when they caught up in the zeitgeist, it's you guys believing the blue-eyed and white Christ. I'm truer than the Buddha when I'm puffing it. These days they got the globe hotter than the oven mitt. Where it be mad rowdy and floating Gwinnett, Cobb in DeKalb County. Schmucks run amok trying to act rowdy, invading my personal space, the face crowd me. Where there's no peace, catching from the police or from being obese. Hot Atlanta still got cold streets, littered with black and miles and gold OEs. It's game over, so freeze. It's why we stay rolling those trees.
And why you pass it to me? I'm a rebel with a cause and it's hypocrisy. This ain't never been a system called democracy. Ain't no people with no power, this is oligarchy. Cousin, we was never meant to succeed. Overweight, underpaid, and babies can't read. Ain't no child left behind, but who's in the lead? We must organize, educate, and be by our dream. Cause miss, nothing but a clean lady. Who be taking all our pockets to the laundry? And little drummer boy has got us all marching on beat. While red, white, and blue is killing up the Middle East. Monsanto's farmers are terminating the seed. If you want fresh fruit, then uproot your trees. Whether deer and antelope playing, at least one single child goes hungry every day. And young gifted black means you could catch a case. Judged by a jury with no trace of grace. In used to be indigenous land, so grab my hand, your hand, and slap the man. In unison, we stand, we making demand. And got a whole new plan for this land, your land.
They want us to be like them.
I'm not gonna play games with you anymore.
That was a track called America by Dylan and Bat Sauce. You are listening to Animal Voices here on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. This week, you wrote in with vegan diet-related questions. Here to answer your questions, we are joined by Virginia Messina. Virginia Messina is a registered dietitian and public health nutritionist specializing in vegan nutrition. She has a degree in nutrition and a master's degree in public health nutrition. Ginny has worked as a dietitian for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, taught nutrition to dietetics students at Central Michigan University, and was the director of nutrition services for a medical clinic at George Washington University. Virginia serves on advisory boards to Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine and the Vegetarian Resource Group. Ginny is also the co-author of a new book called Vegan for Life: Everything You Need to Know to Be Healthy and Fit on a Plant-Based Diet. Welcome to Animal Voices, Ginny.
Hi, thank you. It's great to be here, Catherine.
We're happy to have you. First of all, I have to say that I really love your book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
It is a fantastic resource, and I feel like it's given me even more tools that I didn't know were available to help me understand vegan nutrition and what I need to be really healthy. So I'm wondering, though, if we could just start off by talking about your journey. Why did you become vegan, and how did you become a vegan dietitian?
Well, you know, I was actually a dietitian before I became vegan. Veganism, vegetarianism, animal rights, none of those issues were even on my radar way back when I first started as a dietetic student. I was really just interested in nutrition and diet planning and helping people to become healthier. And also, especially, the reason I went into public health nutrition was because I was interested in working with low-income families. But I started kind of reading about, I was reading some vegetarian cookbooks and reading a little bit about factory farming and animal rights as I was becoming a dietitian. And all of those things kind of clicked, and I realized that veganism made sense for me personally because of my beliefs about animals and about animal use. And because I was a dietitian, I realized that I was really in a good position to learn more about vegan nutrition in particular and use that knowledge to kind of help vegans to make sure that they were healthy, because that's really important for the image of veganism. And so that kind of jump-started my career as a vegan dietitian, and I just started reading more of the research and learning more, and that ended up being what I did exclusively.
So in your book, you write that a vegan diet is an effective and meaningful way to put your beliefs into practice. So for you, veganism isn't just a lifestyle choice then, is it?
No, it's not. It's not just a lifestyle choice. I see it as outreach. It's not just the choices that we make so that we're not using animals, but it's a way of showing other people how it's important to show other people how healthy and how easy it is to be vegan so that it can be a realistic choice for them as well.
Hmm. In your book, you also say that a good vegan diet is good advocacy. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I don't want people to be too obsessive about making healthy food choices all of the time, but people have this misconception about vegan diets as being inadequate. You know, they think that we vegans can't get enough calcium or we can't get enough iron or protein, and we need to correct those misconceptions. And the way we do it is by being healthy, by making sure that we're meeting our nutrient needs and, you know, and that we're doing it in responsible ways. And when people see that, when they see that we're healthy vegans, that we don't have problems with low B12 and, you know, we're not walking around being exhausted all of the time and having all kinds of serious nutrient deficiencies, when people see that, then they feel more confident that a vegan diet is a realistic choice and is a healthy choice.
So your new book is called Vegan for Life: Everything You Need to Know to Be Healthy and Fit on a Plant-Based Diet. What made you decide to write this book?
Well, you know, there's so much misinformation, so many misconceptions about vegan nutrition on the internet and in print and just kind of all over the place in all different kinds of media. And the misconceptions sort of work both ways. On the one hand, as I said, people have a lot of fears about veganism. They're afraid that they're not going to meet nutrient needs if they go vegan or that it's going to be really difficult. Jack Norris, who works for Vegan Outreach, and he's my co-author, he and I wanted to correct those misconceptions for sure, for certain. But we also wanted to correct the misconceptions on the other side. Sometimes people think that as long as you're eating a bunch of different kinds of plant foods, you're automatically going to meet your nutrient needs. And that's not necessarily true. Although it's not difficult to meet nutrient needs on a vegan diet, you kind of have to know a little bit about how to do it. And so we wanted to make sure that there was one good resource that compiled all of that information that would correct the misconceptions about vegan diet, help vegans to be really healthy, and just have a place where vegans could go to feel confident that they were getting nutrition information from dietitians who were also animal rights activists. So we share the goals that all the ethical vegans share.
Hmm. And I really appreciate that about your book. It's not, like I said, it's not just about a diet. You actually do include a lot of information about animals and justice to animals and what kind of conditions they're living in. So there is that aspect there that you do extend the book beyond just about diet, you know, and veganism as a lifestyle. And I really appreciate that about it. I'm wondering, though, one of the biggest questions personally that I get, if I tell someone that I'm vegan, they go, oh, wow, that's really great for you, but I could never do that. So there's definitely a perception out there that a vegan diet is difficult. So what do you think? Is a vegan diet difficult?
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, certainly I don't think that a vegan diet is difficult, and I know that you don't think it is either. And it's certainly much easier now. I don't know how long you've been vegan, but I became a vegan about 20 years ago, and it's certainly so much easier these days. There's so many more resources and wonderful cookbooks and amazing convenience foods out there for vegans. That's just made it so much easier.
Mm.
I think that we need to let people know about that. I think, for one thing, we want to make sure that people don't perceive vegan diets as being any more restrictive than they need to be. There's a lot of information kind of floating around on the internet about all of these foods that healthy vegans aren't supposed to eat. For example, some advocates say that vegans should never eat any added fats or never eat soy foods or processed foods. And that does make it hard to be a vegan. When we start piling all of those kinds of restrictions onto a vegan diet, that makes it difficult. So I think that we want to let people know that all plant foods are good. All plant foods can be a part of a healthy, realistic vegan diet. That there are lots of convenience foods out there, veggie meats and veggie cheeses, that can replace the more familiar foods in omnivore diets. And when you take advantage of those, it really is so much easier to be a vegan. So I think that we want to encourage a very open-minded view of veganism and encourage people to explore all kinds of vegan foods and not just stick, you know, with this idea of only whole plant foods on your vegan diet. You can have some convenience foods as well.
So to be a really good vegan, to have optimal health, we don't have to eat only whole foods, only raw foods with no fats, no flavor.
Right. any kind of a plant food can fit into a healthy vegan diet.
That's great. And I've had a really positive experience with vegan. I've been vegan for over 3 years, which doesn't seem like very long compared to your 20 years of experience. but yeah, sadly, that's not always the case for everyone. And, you know, you do hear about a friend of a friend who went vegan and then developed all sorts of deficiencies and, you know, or almost died or something like that. And, you know, while I like to think that ex-vegans don't actually exist, I feel like we should talk about some of the reasons that a person might not do well on a vegan diet.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right, you know, and again, this is why we wrote Vegan for Life, because there are people out there who go vegan and who don't do well on a vegan diet, and that kind of contributes to this misconception that a vegan diet is unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true. It's simply that these people who don't do well on a vegan diet just need more good nutrition information. And I do think that sometimes people eat vegan diets that are too low in protein and fat. And when we look at the, you know, at the typical American diet, it's fairly generous in both protein and fat. So when people make this switch to a diet that's very low in both of these nutrients, you know, it might not necessarily affect their health in a negative way, but they might feel sort of this vague sense of a lack of satisfaction, like something's not quite right with their food, and it creates an impression that there's something lacking in their diet. So we really encourage the inclusion of some higher fat foods in vegan diets, like nuts and avocados, and healthy fats like olive oil, and also getting plenty of protein-rich foods, specifically legumes, cooked dried beans, peanuts, soy foods if you like them and if you don't have allergies. Making sure that you have enough of those foods in your diet can really go a long way towards making you feel more satisfied and also towards making sure that you're meeting nutrient needs.
Mm. Definitely the protein question is a big one. We did have a few people write in with protein questions, so now might be a good time to talk more about protein. And certainly, you know, one of the biggest assumptions and a highly circulated myth is that protein comes from meat. It only comes from flesh. There isn't protein in plants. So can we break that down? Can we dispel some of that myth?
Yeah, I mean, obviously you and I would have keeled over from protein deficiency long ago if that were true. Plants do contain protein, and there's, you know, there's no real difference between the protein in plant foods and the protein in animal foods. Protein is made up of amino acids, and plants and animals have the exact same amino acids. Both types of food can provide plenty of protein. As most vegans have heard, plant foods tend to be lower in one or more of the amino acids. And the old way of thinking about that was that we needed to combine plant foods in order to get all of the amino acids. But that theory has been pretty much tossed out. In fact, it was tossed out a long time ago, way back in the early 1990s, when worldwide protein experts realized that for a variety of reasons, as long as you're getting enough protein from any type of food, and as long as you're eating a variety of plant foods and meeting your calorie needs, you don't need to eat any special combinations. So eating a variety of plant foods throughout the day, that means eating some grains, some legumes, some vegetables, some nuts and seeds throughout the day is enough to meet protein needs. But on the other side of the coin, there's also, some vegans believe that it's impossible to be deficient in protein. And that's not exactly true. As I said, legumes are really important for meeting protein needs. And if vegans don't include any of these dried beans or peanuts or soy foods in their diet, it is possible to get too little protein. But as long as you're eating a variety of foods, you're meeting your calcium needs, you're eating some legumes, you're going to meet protein needs without even thinking about it.
That makes perfect sense to me. So, but certainly in the existing food guides, you know, the animal agriculture industry has had a large part in shaping what those look like. And, you know, as far as the protein category goes, there's pretty much just animal options, animal-based options. And, you know, those food guides are pretty much useless for vegans. But you have provided a food guide in your book. Can you give us a short rundown of what the vegan food groups are?
Yes, the vegan food groups are actually very similar to the USDA's food guide. It's just that we've taken out all the animal foods and left just the plant foods, and it creates a perfectly good, valid, health-promoting food guide. The food groups are whole grains, and we include starchy vegetables in that group, like potatoes and sweet potatoes. So for people who don't like to eat a whole lot of grains, you can still get plenty of carbohydrate-rich foods just from eating starchy vegetables. That's the first group. The second one is legumes and soy foods, and that group also includes peanuts because they are botanically and nutritionally legumes. And then we have a nuts and seeds group because these are foods that provide healthy fats and trace minerals, especially zinc and iron. And then, of course, we have a vegetable group and a fruit group and a small group for added fats like vegetable oils and soft margarines.
Okay, about oils. I actually started taking an oil called, well, it's called Udo's oil, but essentially it's flaxseed and hemp seed oil. The idea was to address the issue of omegas, omega 369. It has DHA and GLA in it. I'm not sure what DHA or GLA are. but I do know that once I started using it on salads or putting it in my smoothies, once I started taking these oils, eating these oils, incorporating them into my daily, you know, my daily meals, it actually changed my ability to read and think. I stopped falling asleep after reading for 20 minutes. And I actually noticed a real change. I've also heard, though, that it's only really omega-3s that we should worry about. Can you break some of this down for us? I don't understand.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, sure. I know the situation with essential fatty acids is really, really complex, so it's not too surprising that people get confused about this. But basically, there are two essential fats in the diet, and by essential, I mean that these are actual nutrients. We have to have them in order to stay alive. And one of them is called linolenic acid. It's an omega-6 fat. You don't need to worry about it. It's so abundant in plant foods that it's just about impossible to not get enough. The other one is the omega-3 fat called linolenic acid that is found really only in a handful of plant foods. You know, that's why you're taking the supplement with flaxseed and hemp seed oil in it. Those two oils are a good source of this essential omega-3 fat. Mm. And so that's why we have this little fat group in our food guide to make sure that people get enough of that omega-3 fat. The other two omega-3 fats, DHA and EPA, these are the ones that people typically associate with fish oils because fatty fish are abundant in these fats.
Okay.
And they're not technically essential in the diet, but there is quite a bit of research suggesting that these are health promoting and that it's a good idea to have them in your diet. Vegans can get DHA and EPA from, they're sourced from algae. That's where fish get their DHA and EPA also, from eating algae. So we can just kind of skip the fish and go straight to supplements that get these two omega-3 fats from algae. Mm. If your supplement is a vegan one, which I assume it is, that's where the DHA is coming from, and it probably says that on the label.
Mm-hmm.
So I take a DHA supplement every day also. The jury is really out on whether we need DHA and EPA. As I said, there's a lot of research on it. It's very conflicting, but it is possible that this is helpful for vegans to take these supplements. And just to kind of err on the side of caution, we do recommend it in our book that vegans use a supplement of DHA, EPA, omega-3 fats at least 2 or 3 times a week.
Mm. So if I'm eating foods with flax in it, or like, would that be enough? Or is it something that I really want to pay careful attention to?
I think it's something that you will probably want to pay attention to. You know, we know that the type of fat that's in flaxseed and hemp seed can be converted to these other omega-3s, the DHA and EPA. And that's why we don't necessarily need DHA and EPA in our diet, because we can technically make it from the fats that are in flaxseed and hemp seed and a couple of other plant fats. But the research suggests that people don't do this very efficiently. And so it shows that vegans typically have pretty low levels in their tissues of this DHA and EPA. And so that's why we recommend taking the supplements.
Mm. I wanted to shift gears a little bit and ask you about vegans on a budget. You said that you went into public health through working with low-income families, so this has got to be something you've developed some tips or tricks to help people who don't have a whole lot of money to be really successful with a vegan diet.
Well, yeah, you know, a vegan diet can obviously be very expensive. You know, if people are using a lot of veggie meats and special condiments and special deep products, those foods tend to be fairly highly priced. And so it is possible to spend a lot of money on a vegan diet. And I think that for some people, that's kind of created the image of a vegan diet as being more costly. But when you think about what a vegan diet is really based on, it's grains and legumes. And those are the cheapest foods in the world. That's what most people in the world are eating, because those foods are so readily available and so low cost. So if you're really trying to save money, then looking at whole foods like whole grains, legumes, some processed foods like texturized vegetable protein made from soy, that's really inexpensive and it's a great source of protein and it's very versatile, especially if you can find it in bulk in a natural food store. That's a really good food to add to your diet to give it a nutrient boost for very little money.
Mm-hmm.
And then fruits and vegetables, of course, that's not an additional expense for vegans because everybody's supposed to eat lots of those. So I think that if you decrease your intake of convenience foods, it's going to drop the cost of your food considerably.
Mm. I'm wondering if we can talk about building a vegan pantry. I remember when I first went vegan, it was all about taking things away. oh, can't have this, can't have that. But eventually it actually became about adding things, and it became really fun. It became about trying new things and using things in a different way. So what foods do you recommend every vegan should have in their pantry as a basic staple? And, you know, this hopefully can help people that are considering transitioning toward a vegan diet as well.
Well, we have a Stocking the Vegan Pantry section in Vegan for Life, and I think it spans about 7 pages. So that gives you some idea of how many foods. And those aren't all of the foods that vegans eat, but I think it gives you an idea of how extensive the choices are on a vegan diet. You're absolutely right. You know, when people first go vegan, they think it's about taking everything away. But I think a lot of people say that when they went vegan, their diet became more interesting and their food choices expanded, which may not seem to make sense. But I think that, for one thing, a lot of vegans end up exploring more different kinds of cultural diets and ethnic dishes, because those foods do tend to be plant-based. And so I think that one of the great things that you can do with your vegan pantry is to have a shelf just for all different kinds of condiments that are used in different types of ethnic cooking, different kinds of curry powder or curry paste and coconut milk and sauces and hot sauces and sesame tahini, which is sesame paste, which is used to make hummus. All different kinds of nut butters.
Almond butter is my favorite.
Almond butter, yeah, I know. And that was something that I never had before I became a vegan. I had never even thought about it.
I know, I didn't know it existed. Changed my life.
Yeah, absolutely. And then also there are lots of products like vegan mayonnaise and vegan sour cream and vegan cream cheese, things that some people use in their cooking a lot, and they think, oh, you know, what am I going to do now that I can't have cheeses and egg-based mayonnaise? Those products are all out there. There are vegan forms of all of those products.
I know.
So if you have something like a Whole Foods nearby or a natural food market, or really even the natural food section of most mainstream grocery stores, if you start exploring the options there, it's just amazing how many wonderful vegan products there are and how many of them mimic the foods that omnivores are used to eating.
That's right. I went for the first year of my transition in veganism thinking that I couldn't have any form of milk because I didn't like soy milk, thinking that I couldn't have butter, that there was no other way to eat butter that, you know, wasn't made from dairy. And I honestly, I didn't know that there was vegan mayonnaise. So if there's anybody out there that doesn't know about veganaise, please go to the grocery store
and
explore.
It's really wonderful. Actually, the first time I shared that with a friend who is an omnivore, she said that it tasted like old-fashioned homemade mayonnaise.
Yeah,
much more
delicious.
So than any of the regular mayonnaise products that you can buy in the store. So a lot of these products are not, they're not substitutes for the animal-based products. They're actually better versions of them, not just from a health perspective and an ethical perspective, but sometimes from a taste perspective too.
That's so nice to hear and to finally figure out when you are, you know, radically changing the way that you look at food and eat food.
Right. And of course, when I first went vegan, soy milk and rice milk, those were the only two options for people to use instead of cow's milk. And now we have hemp seed milk and coconut milk and oat milk and almond milk has become really popular, and it's just wonderful. And, you know, I think that that's an example of what I was saying before about how vegans often say that their food choices expanded when they went vegan. If you're not vegan, you're probably just using cow's milk. That's what most of us grew up with. That's all that we think about. Mm. But when you go vegan, you start exploring all of these other options, and there are lots of them, and they're really good.
I agree. So what's your best advice for somebody who is transitioning into veganism, or for somebody that's helping someone else transition into a vegan diet?
Well, you know, it depends, of course, on their motivation and on their own particular situation. For example, somebody who has a family with little kids might need to approach veganism a little bit differently than a college student, for example, or someone who's living on their own. But I do encourage people, first of all, to make the really, really easy substitutions right away, simply because they're kind of no-brainers and they don't affect the taste of your food and the preparation of your food. And these are the things that we've just been talking about, like replacing regular commercial mayonnaise with veganaise, replacing cow's milk with a plant milk and trying all of the plant milks and finding the ones that you like and that your family likes. Mm. Replacing cream cheese with tofu-y soy-based cream cheese. Those are, you know, there's small changes in the way that you eat, but they are so easy that there's really just no reason not to do them. You know, they just don't cost you anything in terms of effort and changing your cooking patterns. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I suggest that people just start looking at the kinds of dishes, the kinds of menus for dinner, for example, that they enjoy, and look at the ones that can easily be made vegan. For example, if the family favorite is something like spaghetti with meat sauce or with meatballs, there are vegan alternatives to that. You can use one of the vegan ground beef type veggie meats and spaghetti sauce, or buy something like Nate's vegan meatballs or mm-hmm. veggie balls. I'm not sure what they're called. Again, those are really easy, easy changes to make. They don't change the way you're cooking. You're not suddenly presenting your family with, you know, tofu surprise casserole. they're familiar kinds of foods. And one thing that I like to remind people, and we talked about this a little bit in our book, is that the average person doesn't really eat that diverse a diet. The average American family has a dinner menu rotation of about 7 to 10 different meals. So when you think about coming up with 7 to 10 new vegan meals, it's not that overwhelming. It's not that many new recipes. You can explore some vegan cookbooks and come up with a few new things, kind of tweak the things that you already like to make them vegan. And within a month or a couple of months, most people can make that transition to vegan meals pretty easily.
And I just love that about the book. And I really didn't realize it until I read through that section that, yeah, you know what, you're probably right. There is sort of a set of go-to recipes that I eat pretty consistently. And, you know, I like to keep things interesting, switch it up, maybe eat out. But, yeah, I think knowing that, I think that helps. That's, you know, it's reassuring and it makes it more manageable. It makes it more doable, right? And it is, again, about adding, right?
It's about adding and it's about tweaking. If you like to cook, it can be really fun to explore vegan cookbooks and add some new recipes. If you don't like to cook, you know, head to the store and explore some of the convenience products and try those. Mm. So adding and then kind of tweaking what you already eat that can easily be made into a plant-based meal, you know, that can get you about 75 or 80% of the way there. And then it's just a matter of over time, you know, over a period of months or whatever amount of time it takes you and your family, just, you know, slowly making changes that you can really stick with and that feel comfortable. Hmm.
So I'm wondering now if we can shift gears again and turn to some of the questions that our listeners have for you. One of the biggest questions was about B12. Mm-hmm. So we had many people write in about B12, and I guess what people are pointing at is it actually possible to get all of the vitamins, all of the minerals that you need from plants?
Yeah, you know, it's not possible to get vitamin B12 from plants. Plants don't make vitamin B12, and so we do need to look for an external source of this nutrient. And, you know, it's such a tiny nutrient, and it's so easy to get enough vitamin B12. You know, it's kind of unfortunate that this becomes sort of the center of vegan nutrition, but it is really, really important. It's an extremely important nutrient, and people who don't have a source of vitamin B12 in their diet can develop serious nutrient deficiency. So the way to get vitamin B12 is to either consume a food that is fortified with vitamin B12, and many vegan products are. Some cereals and veggie meats and plant milks are fortified with vitamin B12. You just need to look on the label. Or consume a food like nutritional yeast that is grown on a B12-rich medium. Not all types of nutritional yeast are. The one that I always recommend is Red Star brand vegetarian support formula, because that is reliably a good source of vitamin B12. Or the other option, and the one that I use and that is so easy, is to simply take a vitamin B12 supplement. And I take one every day of about 25 micrograms of cyanocobalamin, which is the scientific name of vitamin B12. And that's what you need to do to make sure that you get enough of this nutrient. And we do see from studies that vegans who don't supplement with vitamin B12 or use fortified foods are likely to have low blood levels of vitamin B12, and we just don't want that to happen.
Mm. Just following up on the best way to actually get B12, is it true that taking a B12 that goes under your tongue is better than actually ingesting a pill, or does it really matter?
I recommend either taking it under the tongue, sublingual, or using a pill that can be chewed just to make sure that it's completely well digested. Mm. There's a little bit of research showing that swallowing a vitamin B12 pill whole, that the B12 will not always be well digested and absorbed. There's not a whole lot of research on this, but just because we want to be so sure that vegans are getting enough vitamin B12, I think it's a good idea to either chew the pill or let it dissolve under your tongue to make sure that you're absorbing it.
So for the vegans out there that are convinced that they don't need to take a B12 supplement, just to be really clear, what you're recommending is absolutely, without a doubt, take a B12 supplement.
Absolutely, without a doubt. And there is really no controversy about this among vegan nutrition experts. Everybody is in agreement with the fact that vegans need to do this to ensure good health. And I always like to point out that this is important animal advocacy, because if vegans end up with a vitamin B12 deficiency, then the anti-vegan people, people who are, you know, trying to convince everyone that a vegan diet is unhealthy, they have ammunition for this. Mm. You know, they can point to unhealthy B12 deficient vegans and say, look, see, this diet is not healthy. And we don't want that to happen. It's really important for vegans to get enough of all nutrients. And taking a vitamin B12 supplement is just such a easy, simple way to do this.
I was actually talking about B12 while talking about your book with a friend, and the conversation inevitably was centered around the question, does the fact that we can't reliably get B12 from plants mean that vegan diets are inadequate or unhealthy? How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I know. It's a really hard question, and it's a really hard issue. You know, when we look at the evolution of humans, it's pretty clear that humans have always consumed at least small amounts of animal products, and that's probably how they were getting their vitamin B12. And the environment was different. You know, some, you know, plant foods may have had B12 dirt clinging to them, and it's possible that people were getting vitamin B12 that way as well. But I just don't like to get too hung up on trying to prove that a vegan diet is the natural diet of humans, or, you know, trying to counter the argument that if we can't get B12 from a vegan diet, then it can't be natural. I don't like to get too bogged down in those kinds of conversations, because we know, when we look at the world today and how animals are treated, the fact that we can get enough vitamin B12 by using these fortified foods or taking a vitamin B12 supplement, that makes it so easy to be vegan, and therefore there is no reason not to be vegan. To me, it's the only ethical dietary choice. And if taking a vitamin B12 supplement is the difference between being able to be vegan and not being vegan, that's just a small thing to do. So it's a question that comes up a lot, and it is a really hard question. But the fact of the matter is, we can be vegan. We can be healthy vegans, and therefore we should, no matter what our ancestors were doing.
Yeah, and it's such a simple solution. Just take the supplement, right?
That's right.
Like, it couldn't be easier. And I'm happy to say that after reading your book, I am officially taking a B12 supplement. I haven't been.
Oh,
for the
I
last...
feel so happy to hear that.
So, and so is my roommate, and hopefully so will the listeners. so will all of you out there listening to this this B12 conversation. One of the other things that I learned about B12 in your book was about inactive and active B12. Now, I didn't understand a thing about this. Can you explain to listeners what's the difference between active and inactive, and why does this matter for vegans?
Well, there are compounds in some plant foods like sea vegetables and some of the fermented soy products like miso and tempeh that are vitamin B12 analogs. Chemically, they look very much like vitamin B12, but they don't have any vitamin activity in the body. Not only that, but they can actually block absorption of active vitamin B12. So people who believe that these foods actually contain vitamin B12, it's kind of like a double whammy, because they end up depending on these foods and not taking a vitamin B12 supplement. Not only are they not getting enough vitamin B12, but this analog in their diet is blocking any small amounts of vitamin B12 that they might be getting. Mm. That doesn't mean that it's bad to eat these foods. I eat sea vegetables and tempeh and miso all the time. They're perfectly healthy foods as long as you have a source of active vitamin B12 in your diet.
Okay, that clears that up. Yeah, because there's definitely a conversation around, well, can you get it from sea vegetables? Can you get it from unwashed organic vegetables? Can you get it from this or that? And like I said, just to be really clear, what you're recommending is across the board, just take a B12 supplement.
Supplement or fortified foods, that's
yeah.
right.
Okay.
Yeah. These other foods, for a long time we thought that these might be sources of vitamin B12, but the scientific tests of the foods have shown that what they contain is not active vitamins. So no, mm-hmm. they can't be relied upon as a source of vitamin B12.
And for those of you that pick up the book, you'll have a good chuckle when you read the chapter that's called Vitamin B12, the Gorilla in the Room. So another big theme in the questions that were sent in were about iron deficiency. Now, mm-hmm. can you explain what the difference, if there is a difference, between iron found in meat and iron found in plants? Is there a difference? Mm-hmm. Why does it matter?
Yeah, there is a difference. The iron that's found in animal flesh is called heme iron, and the type that's found in plant foods is non-heme iron. They're both good sources of iron. You know, we can use both of them as a source of iron in our diet. The difference is really in how they're absorbed. And iron from plant foods is not absorbed as well as iron from animal foods. This non-heme iron is not absorbed as well. So that is potentially a problem for vegans, but it's another one of these issues that's easily fixed because we can do things to improve the absorption of non-heme iron from plant foods. And the big thing is vitamin C. When you consume a good source of vitamin C, like citrus fruits or orange juice, broccoli, peppers, potatoes, watermelon, any food that's a good source of vitamin C, when you consume those at a meal, it dramatically boosts the absorption of iron from plant foods. And it doesn't have that effect on the iron from animal foods, incidentally, only on plant iron. So what we recommend and what most vegan nutrition experts recommend is that you eat a diet that's very rich in plant iron, whole grains, legumes, nuts and seeds, lots of different vegetables like spinach are good sources of iron, and then include a good source of vitamin C at every meal. Mm. Some type of fruit or vegetable that's rich in vitamin C, and this really just dramatically increases iron absorption and improves iron nutrition.
Thanks. That clears that up. We're just going down the list, like, check. Myth number one, check. All right. So one of the questions that I'll just read out the question, actually. I think it gives you a bit of a background. And it's about soy. So I'll just read it now. This is from Virginie. So I've been vegan for 5 years, had a vegan pregnancy, and now a vegan baby. I always worry about the amount of soy in my diet and now in my baby's diet. How much is too much? And specifically about my baby, I'm still breastfeeding, but he is almost a year old and my supply is decreasing, so I want to supplement with soy milk. I worry that he's too young for so much soy, though.
Yeah, that is a really big question. When we talk about how much soy is safe in a vegan diet, I think that the easiest thing and the best thing to do is to look towards Asian cultures where soy foods are a usual part of cuisine and of diets. And when we look at the studies of Asian intake of soy foods, and there are many, many studies of this, we see that in Japan in particular, average intake of soy foods, and this would be things like tofu and soy milk and miso, average intake is about 1.5 servings per day. At the upper end of the range of average intake, and this is particularly older Japanese people who eat a more traditional Japanese diet, they eat around 2 to 3 servings of soy foods per day. So that tells us that up to 3 servings of soy foods per day in a vegan diet is a reasonable amount of soy to consume, especially from traditional foods like tofu and soy milk, and in Indonesia, tempeh is a traditional food, and also miso. And we haven't seen any reason to think that this amount of soy is problematic in children's diet either. And we haven't seen any problems with babies who were raised on soy infant formula, for example, and families where breastfeeding is not an option. In vegan families where breastfeeding is not an option, babies are typically fed soy infant formula, and soy infant formula has been in use for at least 50 years, and we haven't seen any evidence of any problems as a result of that. You know, I wrote a couple of papers in the Journal of the American Dietetic Association several years ago with Dr. Reed Mangels, who is the nutrition advisor for the Vegetarian Resource Group and is also a vegan, an ethical vegan, and she's raised a couple of vegan kids. And we recommended that in vegan families, when babies are no longer breastfed, when they're switching to all solid foods, that families use fortified calcium and vitamin D fortified soy milk to replace breast milk. And there's no reason to think that that causes any problem for vegan kids.
Thanks. Yeah, hopefully that answer is very helpful. But I think what Virginie is pointing at is that larger question and concern about soy. You know, you hear all sorts of myths that men who eat too much soy will develop feminine characteristics, that if you eat too much soy, it will actually cause breast cancer. So can we talk a little bit more about soy, what the research is saying about soy? Because, you know, is the jury still out, or is there some clear evidence that it can be a very healthy part of your diet?
Yeah, I think the evidence is increasingly clear that it's safe to use these foods. Well, let me back up for a second and talk about what's in soy that raises these concerns. There are compounds in soybeans and in foods made from them called isoflavones. These are also called phytoestrogens. They're plant estrogens. The mistake, and what's given rise, I think, to some of these concerns, is this idea that these isoflavones are the same as the female hormone estrogen. But they're not. They're very different, actually. The way they're processed and their bioactivity in the body is very different in many cases from the female hormone estrogen. In some cases, they act in complete opposite ways. When we look at the studies of breast cancer, for example, there's a growing body of research suggesting that women who have had breast cancer have a better prognosis when they eat soy foods. And there are a couple of studies in China that have shown that, and also one in the United States. There's also some excellent evidence suggesting that young girls who eat soy foods at the time of puberty, during breast development, have a lower lifelong risk of getting breast cancer. So those are really very reassuring and very exciting types of research. These are types of research that suggest that for women in particular, there could be some advantages to consuming soy foods in terms of breast cancer risk. There have been a couple of studies, not really studies, but just observations of individual men who developed feminine characteristics because they were consuming something like 14 servings of soy foods per day. It's pretty crazy to consume 14 servings of anything per day. There was a study a couple years ago of a woman who developed a very, I don't remember exactly what the disease was, but a very serious, I think it was a thyroid disease, from eating many, many servings of the vegetable bok choy every day. And I think that what that shows us is that all plant foods have bioactive chemicals in them. And for the most part, these bioactive chemicals are healthy. But like anything else, if you overdose on them, if you eat really, really high quantities of them, you know, they have biological activity and they can start to become toxic.
Okay.
So I would definitely say that you should not eat 14 servings of soy foods per day. and you wouldn't really be able to eat too much of anything else if you did.
Yeah.
But two to three servings of soy foods per day, there's absolutely no evidence that this causes feminine characteristics in men. There is some evidence that it reduces risk for prostate cancer. So that, you know, that would be an advantage to including these foods in a man's diet.
Another question that we have is actually about breast cancer. I'll read it now. I'm wondering what specific foods Ginny would recommend for someone with breast cancer who is not undergoing surgery, chemo, or radiation yet, but has a cancerous tumor currently. This person is also a bit hypothyroid. Yeah, any help that you can provide?
Well, the research on diet and breast cancer has not been terribly promising in that we just haven't seen any kind of, there's just no proof that any one particular food helps to reverse breast cancer or reduces risk of breast cancer. As I said, soy products, you know, are one food that has been pretty well studied, and there's some exciting research in that area. Mm. But for the most part, you know, we can't say, well, eat more of this and it will lower your risk for breast cancer or reverse breast cancer. Yeah. But of course, there's lots of evidence that the compounds in fruits and vegetables and whole grains and legumes has some anti-cancer activity. So I think in that respect, simply eating a diet that's based on a lot of whole plant foods, and particularly a lot of fruits and vegetables, especially vegetables, is probably the best thing that you can do to lower your risk of breast cancer, lower your risk of recurrence. And even though we don't have any real proof for that at this point, it's definitely something that would never hurt and is probably going to have some benefit.
Mm. Okay, well, hopefully that helps you, Gabrielle. Thank you for writing in with your question.
Yeah, I wish I had something more specific to say about that, but unfortunately the science just isn't there. So, you know, we have to fall back on the fruits and vegetables, which is always good advice for everybody, and especially somebody who's fighting a disease.
So we only have time for one more question, and I think it's a good one because a lot of people will hopefully find it useful. And it comes from Sarah. Sarah says, I was wondering whether or not there is some type of resource or list that shows which ingredients are actually vegan and which ones aren't, in regards to things that can be found in certain foods, for example, gelatin, casein, rennet, etc. I know there are probably lots of other hidden ingredients that not a lot of vegans are aware of.
It's hard because there are so many compounds added to foods and used to create different convenience foods. So, and it's true that many, many of these ingredients are not vegan. My advice, kind of a two-part answer. My advice, first of all, is to definitely concentrate, especially for people who are just starting to go vegan, to concentrate on the big things, you know, getting milk and cheese and ice cream and eggs and animal flesh out of your diet. Goes a long way towards preventing animal cruelty, towards ending the use of animals, because these other things are just byproducts. And once we stop eating the big things, those byproducts will go away. But for people who want to make sure that they're not consuming any of these ingredients, the resource that I recommend is the Vegetarian Resource Group. Their website is www.vrg.org. And they have a pretty comprehensive list of ingredients on their website with information about how they're sourced and whether they're animal or vegetable.
We are out of time, unfortunately, and you were just listening to an interview with Virginia Messina. Virginia is a vegan dietitian and public health nutritionist, and I really recommend picking up her book, whether you're vegan or not. It's called Vegan for Life, Everything You Need to Know to Be Healthy and Fit on a Plant-Based Diet. Thank you so much for being on the show, Virginia.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.
You're listening to Animal Voices here on CIUT 89.5 FM, University of Toronto's community radio station. You can also listen to Animal Voices on iTunes Radio under the College University category on Star Choice Channel 826 or on Rogers Digital Cable Channel 946. To contact the Animal Voices team with comments, questions, or suggestions for show ideas, please email us at animalvoices@gmail.com. Check out our website, animalvoices.ca, to access this podcast along with over 300 others. I hope you've really enjoyed today's show, and stay tuned for Raw Sugar with Charissa.